deserve a fitting for a king. I'm waiting for the time when I can get to Arizona, cause my money is spent on a goddamn ring. Neither party is mine, not the jackets or the elephant. 20,000 Nicky Nicky brothers in the corner of the cell block, but they come from California. Population is none in a desert is sun, with a gun cracker running things under his thumb. Staring hard at the postcards, isn't it odd and unique? Seeing people smile while in the heat of 120 degrees, cause I wanna be free. What's a smiling face when the whole state's racist? Why I wanna holiday, damn it, cause I wanna. So if I celebrate it, standing on the corner, I ain't drinking no 40, drinking time with a 9. Till we get some land, call me the trigger man. Looking for the governor, he ain't loving you hot, but hear the trouble, yeah, he's rubbing you wrong. Get the point and come along, he can get to the joint. I urinated on the state while I was kicking this song. Yeah, you better be fair, the sucker over there. You try to keep it yesteryear, the good old days, the same old ways that kept us dying. Hey, yes, you, me, myself, and I, indeed. What he need is a nosebleed, be between the lines. And then you see the lie, politically planned. And understand that's all she wrote. When we see the real side, the hide behind a vote. And they can't understand why he the man who's singing by the king. They don't like it when I decide to make it. Wait, I'm waiting for the day for the man who demands respect, cause he was great. Come on, I'm on a one mission, forget a politician to honor, or he's a goner by the time I get to Arizona. Well, I got 25 days to do it. If I'm walking away, just watch me go through it. Cause I gotta do what I gotta do. PE number one gets the job done. When it's done and over, well, it's because I drove her through all the static. Now stick for automatic. That's the way it is. You got to get his talking MLK. Gonna find a way. Make the state pay. I'm looking for the day. Hard as it seems, this ain't no damn dream. Gotta know what I mean. This team against team, catch the light beam. So I pray every day, I do every shot I make. Living for culture, I got my not here for Jamaica. Pushing and shaking the structure, bringing down the Babylon. Hearing the circuit, I make it hard for the brown. The hard boulevard, I need it now, more than ever now. Who's sitting on my freedom oppressor? People beater, a piece of the pick. We picked a piece of the land we're serving now. Reparation, a piece of the nation, damn, we got the nerve. Another nigga, they saying classify, we want too much. My people plus the nine is mine, don't think I even double touch. Here's a brother, my attitude is hit, I'm hanging high. I'm blowing up the 90s, started ticking in 86. When the sign get a mind, better stop fearing while we singing now. There will be the day we know who's down and who will go. Go, 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 go. By the time I get to Arizona, zona. By the time I get to Arizona, zona. By the time I get to Arizona.
Why is it, do you think, children are always too young to hear the truth, but never too young to be lied to, systematically, conscientiously, in the name of education?
This is Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. Listen online at freakradio.org.
You are indeed tuned in to Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz. In just a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Ramir Medrano, a Brown Beret, and a UCSU outreach worker. Who was one of the many organizers of Watsonville's May Day Immigrants' Rights March and Rally. We're going to talk about immigration policy. We're going to get into the Schumer policy framework that they dropped out this morning, a so-called reform with some good and some bad to it. That's not a bill, not just a proposal to start that process. We're going to talk about the Arizona law, and I just played a Public Enemy song called By the Time I Get to Arizona, and got a call as well from a dear listener talking about, basically, and these are my words, not his, but demonizing the whole state of Arizona is pretty absurd. However, there is some context to Arizona policy. And I think that when folks are talking to, about, you know, shame on Arizona, rather than the individual people, it feels like it's always absurd to demonize an entire group of people. But to talk about Arizona specifically, it's a question of, you know, the we're talking about Arpaio and McCain, all the you know, discussion around Sheriff Joe Arpaio and his policies, and the song is responding to 1990-91, how Arizona resisted and felt like it was a states' rights issue, that the feds were forcing Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday as a holiday. So without further ado, I'm just going to put that call onto the air here and welcome Ramiro to the phone, if that is indeed you.
Oh, no, it's me, DJ Matter Embryo. Excellent. Are you expecting somebody? I don't want to mess up your plan or anything.
Yeah, he's going to be calling in pretty shortly here, the guest we're discussing. But I was,
absolutely,
you know, just addressing
some of your
calls. So
keep listening.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that, I appreciate that point you're making, and but part of it for me was about even Arizona, you know, perhaps demonizing a state, you know, would be silly and all. And also, just a contextual thing, like even from like an anarchist / socialist / communist perspective, just there are so many times where the federal government has not stepped in to when a statute really says that it is supposed to protect the constitutional rights of its citizens in whatever way. And there is legitimate anger that has built up over the years that I think can be separated from racism and other things. You know, I mean, I know it's hard to do that, but legitimate anger toward the federal government just for its lack of doing anything about the whole situation, which certainly needs addressing for all sides, you know, for all sides' needs, could be improved by a healthy addressing of it. And so that's actually a part that I agree with some of the sentiment in Arizona about. So, and I'll just let you go on. I appreciate what you're doing in there.
All right. Thanks for listening all the way from L.A.
Yeah, you got it.
All right.
I'm going to keep it up. Go Free Radio.
Sounds
Cheers.
Good. Thanks. DJ Matter Embryo hosts a show on Free Radio for quite some time. So, our guest should be calling in pretty shortly here to discuss these policies and more. And one of the things, you know, in the earlier conversation that we had was about some of those very questions about whose role it is in terms of enforcement of policies, because I feel like we can pass policies all day long, this rule, that rule, but when it comes to enforcement that people get hurt, or that the rules aren't enforced because, you know, the classic liberal, or neoliberal or progressive goal often is to pass a policy, make it a rule. And then when it comes to enforcement, there's a whole other question where it comes to, you know, whether the rule is agreed upon, how it came to be passed. And so these anti-authoritarian struggles that you're referring to, anarchists and communists and socialists and different philosophies for how to make decisions collectively as to what rules we're going to impose on ourselves and on each other and how they're going to be enforced is a tough one. And for me, it really comes down to priorities. There's a lot going on, you know, right now, and we're dealing with some big questions in terms of how we enforce any kind of financial regulation or immigration regulation, or what we choose to regulate, what we choose to prioritize. And for me, enforcement of a border, of immigration policy, even if the policy is agreed upon, even if the rules or the process for legal immigration is agreed upon, and even if it comes about in a relatively democratic way, as long as there are other powers, enforcement of those policies is always going to be punitive, disruptive, and it's always going to fall on the backs of punishing, scapegoating those who are least able to access power like that, least able to defend themselves. And so I look at regulations and rules and think that we ought to be making sure that we have comprehensive and legitimate, we'll try again here, comprehensive and legitimate financial regulation as opposed to comprehensive and legitimate immigration or border regulation. Ramiro, is that you there on the phone?
It is me. How's it going?
Wonderful. It's going well. Welcome to Free Radio.
Thank you.
We had a caller from LA call in, responding to the program previous to this one, and so we just kind of started the discussion without you, I'm afraid.
Oh, hey, man, as long as people are talking about it, it could be with or without me, man. Cool.
Well, welcome to Free Radio. You've been a guest here before on the show and on the station. You want to tell folks some of the news from Saturday, some of the your reaction and response to having another immigrants' rights rally, another May Day behind us?
Sure. You know, Saturday was rather peaceful in Watsonville. You know, got a lot of people. I would say the numbers would be about 2,000 people came out in March on Saturday. The great part about marching in Watsonville is that we marched through a lot of low-income communities. You know, a lot of neighborhoods where you know there's a lot of low-income housing and stuff, and a lot of the people come out and support it. And so the march actually started probably with around 400 to 500 people, and it grew exponentially, you know, throughout the march. And so it was great to see just people, you know, stopping their cars, you know, parking their cars on the side, getting off and joining the march. You know, it was good to see mamas with strollers, you know, just coming out of work and coming to march. So, you know, marches in Watsonville are always great. You know, it was a permanent march. It was, you know, the police were there, which I'm not too fond of, but you know, it was another march. So.
Well, so how about the timing with another regressive and punitive immigration law proposed right before May Day?
Right. You know, I just got that email not too long ago and read it pretty quickly, and the Democrats are trying to seize the day once again and trying to propose this law that has a lot of loopholes, and it has a lot of I think bad language in there that I don't think we should accept. You know, I think the struggle should continue to get some, you know, if reform is what, you know, people are looking for, which I think, you know, among other things, it's important. I believe that we have to talk about reforming other things, such as, you know, reforming U.S. foreign policy and reforming, you know, all these enforcement or the way that they're trying to enforce these laws. So.
Well, so for a lot of folks, myself included, this is pretty breaking news. I didn't hear about the Schumer proposal or the framework until I got an email from you. So if you could lay out what we're talking about, because I was mostly referring to Arizona policy in terms of mobilizing people to turn out for May Day. And then, the Monday following, the Democratic senator, you know, drops the proposal for what their understanding is of reform. Do you feel like that was maybe planned, or whether that was, you know, I mean, it's a lot of speculation, but things are coming to a head at this point where the timing is perfect for a May Day rally.
Yeah. I don't know if it was planned. You know, it probably was. You know, the Democrats, any politician, they don't usually do things in the spur of the moment. You know, they always tend to plan things because they're worried about how they're going to turn out. So it was definitely planned. You know, about and it is pretty new. Like I said, I just read it. Briefly this morning, and like I said, some of the language is really I'm not really fond of it. Going back to Arizona, though, yeah, the Arizona law SB 1070 out there is really what prompted, I think, a bigger crowd to come out in many communities. I didn't expect more than what came out in 2006, which is about 10,000 people in Watsonville, but a lot more than what came out in previous years after 2006. So I think people are feeling alienated. I think people are feeling disrespected. They're feeling scared, you know, that these laws are going to come to their state, to their communities, and then what? You know, and then and not to mention that a lot of workers from Watsonville go to Yuma, Arizona, to work in lettuce fields out there. You know, they're following the work. When the lettuce season ends here, it starts in Yuma, and so a lot of them go out there. But you know, it'd be interesting to see how this is going to affect, how this law is going to affect those migration patterns. You know, and if people are going to are instead of going to Yuma, are they going to hang out here? And then what's going to happen? You know, I think that we should hold our local representatives accountable for, because a lot of them were out there in the march on Saturday, you know, and they were talking a lot of, you know, let's support our immigrant brothers and sisters, blah, 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 blah. Okay, well, tell me, what are you going to do when these people, you know, don't go to Yuma, Arizona because they're scared and stay here and don't have jobs? You know what I'm saying? And so how are you going to support your immigrant brothers and sisters?
Well, yeah, there's as much border between California and Arizona as there is Arizona and Mexico.
Right.
What, an invisible line in the sand?
Yes, exactly. Yet another invisible line in the sand.
By the way, hi, Ramiro. This is Jessica. I came in a little late, but I'm another programmer with Teachers for Class 4.
Oh, hi, Jessica. Right on.
So will you walk us through some of the bill, the good and the bad? Or it's not a bill, it's a policy proposal. It's kind of the starting point for that. So you said that there was some language that you're not in support of. If you could, well, I guess let's start with the good. What does it do? What does it include that are some of the things that people have been pushing for over the last few years?
The DREAM Act. The DREAM Act is part of this proposal to be included in its entirety, I guess, because it some of this language is pretty vague, and so it just says, you know, that the DREAM Act would be part of the reform. A lot of students, a lot of us have been pushing for the DREAM Act. It's not perfect, but, you know, a lot of what it contains is what we need. And so the DREAM Act is part of it. Ag jobs is another part of the bill. Ag jobs is being pushed, and it's actually a proposal from the USW. And I'm not too familiarized with what ag jobs is, but I believe it's kind of like a temporary worker program in a sense. And so that's what the USW is pushing for. Once again, I do not agree with temporary worker programs, you know, in any form. You know, they if we do, we go back to the 1940s when the braceros were, you know, was in effect, and all of the discrepancies that came along with it. So those are two of the things that are included. And so it would give undocumented people a path to citizenship, I believe 60 years, you know, to become legalized, quote unquote.
So that's folks who are already living here, or I mean, there's a lot of different categories of immigration and where people are. So which people would have a 6-year path?
I believe that once again, I'm just getting familiarized with this.
Yeah, no worries.
But I believe that it's people who have been here for. Okay, let me. I'm reading it right now, so let mm-hmm. me see. It says, treatment of undocumented immigrants. The proposal would allow the 11 million undocumented immigrants now living in fear of deportation to begin a process that will result in legal status and a normal life without fear of being torn from their family. Undocumented immigrants present in the U.S. from the date the bill is introduced will be eligible for an initial registration program that, assuming no problems are uncovered during a security screening process, will give them provisional status with work authorization and ability to travel abroad.
So how would the U.S. government know whether I crossed the border yesterday or today because there's no record. I mean, I'm not really sure how, like, what are they thinking in terms of enforcement of that part of the law? Because it sounds like, to me, that's almost an open invitation of like, hey, everybody, come on up as fast as you can. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It seems a little heavy-handed.
It's like setting a deadline.
Yeah, kind of like, you know, get here now because the border's about to close down. You know, like, that's what it seems like. This is kind of leading to some sort of justification of really, really tightening up the border.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's another part of that. That's one of the bad parts of the proposal, which is enforcement of the border. But you're right. I don't know how they're going to enforce these laws, these, you know, this proposal, if it passes. I think they're probably going to do like a deadline registration or something, you know, mm-hmm. and whoever signs up, you know. And you're right, though, man. I'd call all my family in Mexico and say, try to somehow get over here before, you know, whatever date.
Right. Yeah. So that's interesting, right? Because that means that there's a lot of people who are going to risk their lives in a very short period of time. I mean, okay, so we can look down that path really easily. The other side of it is that people who are here, how are they to trust the government to be honest about this? I mean, we already have people in schools who are scared to talk about anything. I mean, you know, simple classroom discipline, let alone to walk into an ICE office and declare that they've been living here illegally. This seems like a really sketchy plan.
You're completely right, and I don't know.
You know, I mean, I'm not asking you to defend it, but I kind of am like, wait, really? Is this really?
Yeah, no, definitely. I hear you. I think people are going to be obviously not, they're not going to trust it, but, you know, looking back to, you know, amnesty, mm-hmm. like in the 1980s, I think that once it becomes law, I think that a lot of the Democrats, a lot of people are going to push for, you know, undocumented people to sign up for this, to register for this path to citizenship. And I think a lot of them will. You know, I think that their hope of being here without fear is going to be greater than their fear of getting deported back home, you know?
I still think it's really scary because once the government holds all of these papers and information and addresses and phone numbers and all of these things, if it was me, I think I might be scared of the government rescinding these privileges and using that information against me. It just seems really dodgy. Anyways, that's my two cents.
I agree 100%. I think I'm very distrustful of anything that has to do with you know, the government, and so what? Who's to say that, you know, a World War III is not gonna, you know, come about in the 6 years of passive citizenship, and they, you know, what happens is what happened with the Japanese American who were interned in camps, you know,
right?
That's definitely a possibility.
Well, and this other half in terms of enforcement after. I mean, the so-called amnesty or a path to legalization or whatever process for the folks that are already here, in the past, and it sounds like in this one, in terms of some of the other enforcement measures, it seems like what you're saying is accurate, that this is a like, okay, the folks that are here, you're all good. All you have to do is come in and register. Trust us, you'll be fine. And then everyone else, you know, from here on out, it's full enforcement. It's a militarized border, and you cannot work illegally beyond this, because the other half of this is new enforcement in terms of social security numbers, biometrics, and really, really fancy high tech, enforcement of employment law.
Yeah, definitely. There is some language of biometric, ID cards and like I said, enforcing the border and it's all pretty scary stuff, man. You know, they're talking about funneling millions and millions of dollars into the border, more than what it already is. You know, and And as we've seen, border enforcement in previous years has been a tremendous failure. You know, like, instead of stopping people from trying to immigrate, it just pushes people into, you know, desolate areas of the deserts, you know, places where people have to walk 50 miles, you know, in order to reach a road, you know, without water, without assistance. And so more people have been dying. You know, modest figures say that 3,000 people have died since 1998. I'd say those are modest. Mm-hmm. I'd say maybe it's doubled, you know, the 3,000 people. And so it's all pretty scary stuff, man.
And so obviously the Canadian border is also going to get a wall?
Yeah, right.
Sorry. I had to have some levity in there somewhere.
No. And you know, speaking about the wall, you know, the wall has divided a lot of Native American reservations, man, and a lot of them are pretty pissed off at the Department of Homeland Security, even prompting, like, legal action, you know, to sue the government because it interferes with tribal relations and you know, the just their right to roam freely in their own. I mean, they should be able to roam freely wherever the hell they want to, you know. Mm-hmm. But you know, even with governmental decree and tribal lands, they're totally castrating their, you know, their right to just be Native American.
So in terms of what came out this morning, again, it's not as much a proposal for a bill as much as a statement of intention to negotiate. It seems like some of these policies might even, you know, I'm skeptical after watching healthcare reform, shall we say. If they're going to tackle a comprehensive immigration bill, are they doing what they did before and laying all their chips out on the table? Are these going to be bargaining chips? I mean, is this going to be a big, long fight? Has there been a response? What do you think the politics are going to look like?
I don't know, man. I think they're, like I said, they're trying to seize the day with this Arizona bill, you know, being a major, like, a jump start for the Democrats in trying to pass this, or, you know, pass this immigration reform. They say that they don't have the 60 votes in Congress to pass this bill, but that there are a few Republicans who have supported immigration reform in the past. I really don't know how it's going to look, man. It's going to be interesting to see in the next few months how this plays out. I don't think this is going to pass in this year, but next year might be a possibility.
Well, so here's the hard part, and here's the discussion that we were having just briefly at the beginning of the show. It's a question of federal enforcement of a federal border. A state at this point in Arizona seems to be taking the position that the federal government isn't doing its job. It's not enforcing the laws that it passed. When we decide on a new policy, when we have some kind of immigration reform, you know, ideally that is agreeable. That's a bit of a stretch. It seems like from what we're seeing already and what you're saying about this, this framework, enforcement is already like, we always pass rules that we can't enforce. We always pass unrealistic laws, and the people who are coming up with them are out of touch and just beyond understanding what the effects of those are, and the effects on everyday people, and the effects of people who are actually involved in this process called immigration. So what does Schumer have to do with immigration? What does the Senate have to do with immigration?
That's a good question, man. You know, when we talk about enforcement, and you're right, they always pass laws that they can't enforce. And you know, I want to respectfully correct you for a minute. You say we pass laws that we can't enforce. They pass laws that they can't enforce. You know, It's like it's always people who have nothing to do with anything, who don't really understand things, and it's all for political reasons that take on some of these issues, that they don't understand. And so,
I think that there's something about selective enforcement in there too, though. If you push some really, really strong legislation, yeah, you don't have to enforce it, but every once in a while, when you feel like it, you can flex that muscle and nobody can say anything about it. So I think that it's not meant necessarily to be a broad sweeping enforcement plan.
But that's part of what we're seeing in Arizona, where if there's a harsh measure and then people are mandated to enforce it, then who do we trust to enforce it?
Right. And I just got to the enforcement part of this proposition. You guys want me to read a little bit of it?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, it says, the proposal starts off with a discussion of triggers, quote-unquote, that must be met during the 8 years that legalizing immigrants are in provisional status before they adjust to permanent status. The triggers include an increase in the Border Patrol, ICE worksite enforcement inspectors, technology and infrastructure on the border of Frisco shit, increased immigration court resources, and other items. There are no specifics. Number of border patrol agents, etc., included in the proposal. Outside of the trigger section, more Border Patrol personnel, equipment, and infrastructure are provided for, as well as more resources and personnel at ports of entry. The U.S. Visit Exit Entry Tracking Program will be expanded to all ports of entry, supposedly. Penalties are increased for various violations of immigration law. And then it says, you know, continues with enforcement accountability. Should I keep reading?
Yeah. I'm curious about this. and like I said, I really think it's breaking news for some of the folks listening, because I hadn't read this until you sent it along. So
cool. So
that's why you're on the show.
Right on.
Consider this the evening news.
It says enforcement accountability. In addition to a listing of more resources, there are provisions to increase accountability of personnel deployed on the border. For example, Customs and Border Protection officers will receive training on avoiding racial profiling and how to deal with vulnerable populations, including children and victims of trafficking. Yeah, right. States will be prohibited from enacting their own immigration rules. A border communities liaison office will be established, responsible for conducting outreach to community members and for implementing a standardized complaint process. The proposal would require minimum standards of detention, both for government-run and privately owned detention facilities. It would require the government to, prior to transferring a detainee, wait until arrangements have been made for a detainee's children and to give due consideration to the best interests of a child in decisions relating to detention or transfer. It strengthens protections for children and certain vulnerable populations. And keep going.
Well, there's some important stuff in there. We're talking about institutionalizing private-owned immigrant detention.
Right.
You know, addressing Arizona as directly as, you know, prohibiting states from creating further laws.
Their own laws, yeah.
Wait, hold on. What does that do to states that, or cities or towns that want to be sanctuary cities?
Right.
I mean, that's also a problem on both sides.
Well, in reality, sanctuary cities is not really a law. It's more of a...
It's like a declaration.
Like a declaration of, you know, that we support a blah, 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 blah. But it really makes doesn't give any policies or anything for the cops or anything like that.
Uh-huh. Okay. Anyway, sorry to interrupt, but I was just thinking that.
Well, and this one does. I mean, so we're talking about mandating sensitivity training for ICE officers on avoiding racial profiling. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think it's bullshit.
Wait, tell us what you really think. Don't mince words.
I'm sorry. Sorry about the language.
No, this is pirate radio. Out of town.
I think it's stupid. When you include language about racial profiling in a bill or a proposal, then you know it's going to be a real problem. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, they're saying it in advance.
Right, they're in advance. We will not do this when you know that's exactly what's going to happen, you know?
It seems like legal training. It's like, here's how not to get caught doing this.
Right.
Right.
So then, what... I feel like earlier, and just in terms of discussion and in terms of being involved in immigrant communities and struggles for progress and change in the status quo, there we can come to kind of a basic agreement that there are issues with the current immigration system, to put it as broadly as possible, and to put it a little bit more specifically, that the current system we've got ain't working in terms of serving the needs of people, in terms of driving people into the desert, in terms of those the deaths in the desert and on canals, in terms of communities and families being divided, and you know, from the perspective of folks who have questions, legitimate questions in some cases, about quote unquote security, or from a philosophical point of view, it's like, why do we have a rule if we're not going to enforce it? Like, let's change the rule. So there, from a variety of perspectives, we can see a need for some kind of reform. What alternatives are there to, all of a sudden we have this blueprint from Charles Schumer, all the way over out there in New York. We have what we see in Arizona as a possible blueprint. What other options are out there? What counter proposals are going to be made? And what solutions do you see for the fracaso that is the U.S.-Mexico border?
You know, Danielson, I think that's a really tough question. I always, since I have educated myself on this issue, have said time and time again that before talking about reforming immigration law, we have to reform U.S. foreign policy. And we have to reform, you know, labor laws, international labor laws. And so if we're reforming immigration policy, if we're saying, okay, all the people who are here are going to become legalized after 6 years, in another 15, 20 years, we're going to be in the same situation. Same situation when we have people crossing the border, dying every day, here undocumented, persecuted, and so what needs to change before immigration reform takes place are all of these laws. Reforming all of these laws, getting rid of NAFTA, getting rid of the Free Trade Area of the Americas, getting rid of all CAFTA, all of these, crappy free trade laws and policies that further impoverish people in third world countries and make them want to leave their home to come into a first world country and look for work. It's just, if we look at the numbers before 1994, actually before the 1980s, when real neoliberalist reform started in Mexico, the numbers of immigration to this country from Mexico were considerably lower. I don't have the exact number, but considerably lower than after, post NAFTA, post Miguel de la Madrid and Carlos Salinas de Gortari in Mexico, changing all these laws to benefit U.S. American companies, and NAFTA opening the borders for, not for people, but for companies to go out there and exploit and change the environmental laws and, pay people a measly $6 a day for crappy work. So all of these laws are what we need to talk about first. And unfortunately, we have a president right now who supports NAFTA, who supports the Plan Mérida initiative, giving corrupt governments like Mexico more weapons to kill their own people. They just killed people in Oaxaca, with probably with U.S.-made guns, you know, by paramilitaries who are backed by the corrupt government of Ulises Ruiz Ortiz, who is backed by the corrupt government of Calderon. So all of this first has to be dealt with before we deal with immigration reform. That's my take on it.
Well, now you just answered the question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because you hear all the time, well, why don't you know, Mexicans go back and fix Mexico?
Well, so, like, why don't, I mean, like, fight for a living wage? Or, I mean, what would that even look like?
Well, because there's this perception that, you know, people I've heard the perception is that it's not our problem. And that all the immigrant communities in this country should, you know, fix their own country. It's not our responsibility.
It's a matter of, you know, what I tell people, and I hear from my family all the time. You know, as a Mexicano, I'm telling you that even Mexicans, us ourselves, we feel guilty for leaving our home and you know, looking for a better life without having the answers, you know, or the guts to fight for a better, you know, representation in government, for better conditions in Mexico. But in reality, you know, when you have, you know, a U.S. government that is funneling millions and millions of dollars, millions and millions of weapons into a government who, you know, doesn't think twice about using it against its own people, when you have, you know, millions of people in the U.S. Craving illegal drugs, and cartels in Mexico providing those drugs, you know, and killing anybody who stands in the way. You know what, man? I don't care who you are, what nationality, what race. You know, you're gonna find it hard to change those conditions in your own country. What I tell people is that it's bigger than just Mexico is corrupt. It's bigger than just, you know, Mexico sucks. No, it's a lot bigger. It's a global phenomenon. It's not just that Mexicanos are migrating to first world countries. It's that Latin Americans are migrating to first world countries. It's that, you know, Africans are migrating to first world countries. It's that, you know, Southeast Asians are migrating to first world countries. So, you know, before you pointing the finger at just, you know, Mexico is corrupt, you know, let's talk about the real global issues. The WTO, the IMF, you know, all these labor laws and policies, let's talk about those wars, you know, let's talk about that. And let's talk about the U.S.'s role, and not only the U.S., the other first world countries' role in all of these, you know, policies, laws, and conditions.
Yeah, I mean, let's be clear, like, as long as the money and the resources are all migrating to the U.S. and to first world, like, the people are also going to want to follow the money and the resources. It doesn't make sense for us to expect that we can level a forest, you know, kill people, siphon drugs and money and cheap labor and material resources out of a country and expect the people to just, like, kick around and enjoy the shit that's left over. Like, that, yep. That's a pretty heavy-handed logic there, that we would expect the people to just stay behind and keep working for us.
And, you know, part of my family comes from the state of Nayarit in Mexico, which it's a small state in the coastal region of in the Pacific you know, coast of Mexico. But it, in the 1970s, before Miguel de la Madrid became president, which, by the way, Miguel de la Madrid and its predecessor Salinas de Gortari were educated in Harvard, okay, just to put it out there. They're the first Mexican presidents to be educated in the U.S., and they're the ones who presented neoliberalist policies and just thought into Mexican politics. So before the 1980s, when Miguel de la Madrid became president, Nayarit was a booming economy of tobacco. They used to harvest tobacco. People from all over the country in Mexico would go to Nayarit to work, because it was just you know, rich in this local farming industry of tobacco. And as soon as Miguel de la Madrid came in and his predecessor, Salinas de Gortari, he took out Article, what was it, Article 94, I believe, or 24, something or other, which stated that the ejido system they were going to take away. As soon as that happened, the tobacco crops in Nayarit plummeted. And then they, you know, after NAFTA, they started building Walmarts, they started building maquiladoras, and these low-skilled, low-paying jobs, you know, they took the, you know, the place of all of these jobs in the tobacco industry. And I've met people in Nayarit who before them, their parents owned tobacco land. And, you know, they lived well. They could afford to buy, you know, a tractor every year with a year's, you know, earnings of their land. They could afford a nice life, education for the children. Nowadays, you know, the children of those tobacco farmers have to rent or lease their land to American companies, and they come here as undocumented workers to work as day laborers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just an example of the big picture. That is the big picture right there. You know, when you have land and you can't work it because, you know, you're competing against subsidized American companies, then, you know, and that's the reason why so many people become undocumented and why so many people risk their lives in crossing the border to come here to find work.
Ramiro, you're laying it all out, and we appreciate your time here on Teachers for Class War. This is coming back kind of full circle to the discussion about, you know, what we choose to prioritize, and, you know, if there's two issues on the front page right now, it seems to be immigration reform and financial markets reform. And, you know, for me as a member of the society, and this time I'll use the we that includes all of us instead of the we that includes, you know, those who recognize this particular government, getting together, all of us, and deciding on a way to regulate an economy that won't do damage to the most vulnerable among us seems like it might, you know, have something to do with the border and with immigration reform. It seems like if some of the most vicious and destructive parts of the economy, including those ones that you're describing, you know, were it had took a different form, or if certain things, enforcements, certain regulations there were enforced, then there wouldn't be quite the same clamor for sealing the border to folks that are bearing the brunt of those policies and being affected most directly. So,
I totally agree, man. Like I said before, you know, if all of these policies are, you know, one day magically all of a sudden, you know, changed, you know, all these international labor laws and free trade agreements, and if they're all revoked and something else is put in place where we, you know, we can work and be sure that countries like Mexico are going to get back up on its feet. Man, me, I was born in Watsonville. I'll pick up my stuff and leave the day that happens. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, as much as I love my community, as much as I love, you know, all y'all, you know, I'm going to feel the call for duty. You know, I'm going to feel the call for action to go back and work to make things happen, you know, and in the country where my parents were born and where I still feel strong ties to, you know. So, but until that happens, you know, we're going to be here trying to challenge this government to you know, to think outside of the box.
That's an interesting perspective. The discussion of identity and talking about, you know, folks who in terms of the climate changing, in terms of places like Arizona, whether folks are going to stay and dig in and fight, whether folks are going to say, oh, you know, this is too much. This is too punitive. I can't live in fear anymore. And then just the basic bottom gut level instinct of I'm going to do what it takes to provide for my family. I'm here. This is my community. I'm not going anywhere. And then the basic gut level instinct of I'm going to go where my parents were born. I'm going to go to the land that there are roots there beyond the ones that I've, you know, set myself. And so when we're talking about a global economy and institutions as big as WTO, it feels really good to hear the individual, you know, level as well of just feeling, you know, like where would I go in an ideal world? Where would I go? Where do I feel like is home?
Right. Yeah. I mean, honestly, and I can tell you that a lot of us Chicanos, you know, we feel that way, you know, but when, and like I said before, when there are forces, global forces that are, you know, making our homeland so insecure and so, you know, just volatile, you know, it's scary, man. It's scary to, and my hat is off to those who, you know, having the opportunity to be in a safe haven like the United States is, quote unquote, safe haven. They go back to you know, places like Mexico or Latin America or Africa or anywhere else to fight that fight. Man, you know, my hat is off to those people, and many have lost their lives because of that. Just recently, you know, a couple of activists in Oaxaca, and before that, you know, Brad Will in Oaxaca, and the countless others that have, you know, lost their lives fighting out there, man. You know, and but I can tell you right now that if we would feel a sense of hope, a lot of us would you know, pack up and go help, you know.
Well, and I asked that question with full awareness of the ignorance of assuming that folks in Mexico are not struggling against the government and struggling for their own freedom and struggling to make their communities better. Several of the last few shows we've done here on Monday night have been about social movements and struggles in Mexico, including labor struggles and struggles against, you know, corporate control of the media. And people struggling for the human rights and land rights and environmental rights and property rights to stay on their own land. I don't mean property rights in the, like, private property above all. I mean property rights in the sense that this is the land that my grandparents are buried on and you're not pushing me off.
Right, yeah.
So there are, the stakes is high, but folks are fighting back every single day in Mexico and trying to make the country a better place, of course.
And just to point something out, even among Mexicans here in the U.S., the Oaxaqueño community is sometimes looked down upon because they're indigenous, because a lot of them don't speak Spanish, because of racism, you know. And I can say proudly that Oaxaca is one of the states that has resisted for longer and more, you know, have stood their ground a lot more than any other state in Mexico. And so for anybody, you know, who is a Mexican descent, Chicano, Mexicano, listening to this, you know, you should take your hat off and recognize any time that you come across a Mixteco, Zapoteco, Triqui, indigenous person, and try to befriend them, you know, and try to converse with them about the struggles in Oaxaca, you know.
I think that's a really interesting point, too, that a lot of, I mean, for lack of a better term, gringos don't really understand about the racism within Mexico and within Central America. I think it's kind of like, you know, folks who are brown or, you know, folks who are undocumented are just instantly assumed to be Mexican, even if they just passed through Mexico on their way here and they happen to look indigenous or Central American in any way. It's lost on so many people.
It's the caste system that the Spanish have bestowed upon us, mm-hmm. where we see each other differently, and it, you know, I see Mexico as more of a quote unquote melting pot than the United States itself, you know, because Mexico has so many different people, you know, within its own country, its own borders, You know, just people from, for example, El DF are totally different to people from Nayarit, where my mom's from. People from Nayarit are totally different to Oaxaqueños, and Oaxaqueños are different to, you know, the northern part of Mexico, which is more blonde, blue-eyed, you know, Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a true, like melting pot of Mexico. But because of this history of racism and caste system, yes, I would say it's more racist than the United States itself, you know? In many ways.
Well, we're referring to what's happening in Oaxaca. For folks who aren't aware, I'll just give a super brief statement on that. I'm reading from elenemigocomun.net, which is a source for information about this and struggles in Mexico in general. On April 27th, there was a shooting in which a caravan of social justice and human rights activists who were trying to bring supplies to a blockaded town was fired upon. And what that basically means is that there's a town that's been resisting in Oaxaca forever, shall we say, but was recently blockaded. The water was cut, the electricity was cut, roads in and out were monitored by paramilitary organizations that were trying to break the history of struggle in this particular town in Oaxaca, San Juan Copala. And a group of solidarity activists, including a foreigner, not a Mexicano, put together and participated in this caravan to bring supplies to the blockaded community. The convoy was attacked, was ambushed. Two people were killed, including the director of a human rights organization and a solidarity foreigner. And then in the aftermath, there were several people who had disappeared, who were missing. And the blockade was reestablished, and so it was incredibly difficult to get information about the aftermath and what had happened. On April 29th, a couple days later, Noe Bautista and David Venegas — David is known as El Arije, and was active in the APO and was imprisoned for more than a year, in that stretch — those two actually broke through the paramilitary cordon and got in and announced that the two reporters that were presumed missing are in fact severely injured but still alive. David Celia and Erica Ramirez were missing, presumed kidnapped, presumed disappeared. They were wounded severely but are alive. And so there's more information coming out about this. But Betty Carino, and I'm not going to dishonor this man by mispronouncing his name, but a foreigner who was there doing solidarity work was also shot. They were both hit in the head in the car. So there's a lot of updates and information briefly coming out in terms of getting solidarity information and just simply the fact that the struggle is ongoing and the repression is severe. So for more reading and more information, again, elenemigocomun.net, which simply means the common enemy, is a source for some of that. There are communiques from the organizations involved and calls for action.
Thank you for that bit of information, man.
Well, and for you as well, thank you for your time. We've used up our hour, but I appreciate hearing your personal take on this, as well as questions of simple policy and reaction to some of the recent proposals and discussions around.
It's been an hour already?
Yeah, it's been an hour.
Damn.
around immigration politics. So thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, we appreciate you coming on.
Of course, and if I can just send a shout out to all the Watsonville people, the Brown Berets, all the AB 540 students at UCSD. You know, we're gonna pass the Dream Act someday, man. And, we're gonna get you guys to be here, quote unquote, legally. You know, even though no human being is illegal, we still gotta maneuver through these stupid laws and stuff. So. Thank you guys for an awesome show, and La Lucha Sigue.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot.
Thank you again.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 and www.freakradio.org.